rabbit hole for just one more minute. So, was Paul commanding the Corinthians to contribute?
No.
Really? My point came across very incorrectly. So, but just as you abound in everything, in faith and utterance and knowledge and in all earnestness and in the love we inspired in you, he says, see that you abound in this gracious work also. Jerry and I had a talk about this. We're going to cover this just a little bit this morning because obviously my point came across incorrectly. Paul's point was not that I am not commanding you to lay by in store. That is not his point. Paul's point here is that I'm not commanding you to abound in this contribution. I'm not commanding you to go above and beyond. So let's look at this a little further. He says here, now, brethren, we wish to make known to you the grace of God which has been given in the churches of Macedonia, that in a great ordeal of affliction, their abundance of joy and their deep poverty overflowed in the wealth of their liberality. For I testify that according to their ability and beyond their ability, they gave of their own accord, begging us with much urging for the favor of participation in the support of the saints, and this not as we had expected, but they first gave themselves to the Lord and to us by the will of God. So we urge Titus that as he had previously made a beginning, so he would also complete in you this gracious work as well. And then he goes in to say, but as you abound in everything, in faith and utterance and knowledge and all earnestness and all love we inspired in you, see that you abound in this gracious work also. I am not speaking this as a command, but as proving through the earnestness of others the sincerity of your love also. What had he just said that he is not saying as a command? See that you abound in this gracious work also. Paul's not contradicting himself. It is not Paul's command that the Corinthians abound. It was a command to them to lay by in store. But the amount, whether great or small, was not part of that command. It was a free will offering. God doesn't command us to give beyond our means. But he encourages us to be generous. And that's the point I was trying to get across last week, and I obviously failed at that. So, if we look back at the end of 1 Corinthians, chapter 6 and verses 1 through 4, now concerning the collection for the saints, as I gave order to the churches of Galatia, so also do ye. Is that a command? That is a command, correct? He's not going to contradict himself in the next letter, is he? Yeah. He gave a command to the Corinthians to contribute. Just the same way he gave the command to the churches in Galatia to contribute. Now, concerning the collection for the saints, as I gave order to the churches of Galatia, so also do ye. Upon the first day of the week, let each one of you lay by him in store, as he may prosper, that no collections be made when I come. And when I arrive, whomsoever ye shall approve, them will I send with letters to carry your bounty unto Jerusalem. And if it be meet for me to go also, they shall go with me. There is a command, isn't there? There is a command right there at the end of 1 Corinthians. He is telling those Corinthians, yes, this is a command. Lay by in store. I give you this order. What he's talking about in 2 Corinthians is the abundance of their giving. He's not telling them that he can command them to give beyond their means or to give abundantly. What he has been saying is that he has been boasting about them to the Macedonians that they had committed themselves to give abundantly. And that they had, for reasons that we had discussed, the world got in the way. This sinful man that was in their midst was separating them. Judaizers or idolaters, whoever these false apostles were coming in and pulling them away. Something got in the way of them finishing this generous, abundant work. So, was that a command? That was a command. What did Paul tell the Corinthians? He told them to lay by in store. Did Paul command them to contribute? Yes, he did. We just read that. Paul, however, was not himself trying to order the Corinthians around. He does not lord it over anyone's faith, as he said in 2 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 24. Not that we lord it over your faith, but are workers with you for your joy, for in your faith you are standing firm. God loves free will offerings, and it is Paul's intention to not interfere with the Corinthians' free will offering in this matter of giving. And that's exactly what he says. Rather than commanding them in this matter, Paul gives the Corinthians advice. He doesn't command them to abound. He advises them to be generous. The command to give was already given. The Corinthians had committed themselves to generosity. And Paul is following up with that, telling them that they need to, he advises them to continue in that work, to be generous, to fulfill the boasting that he had made about them, that they had already committed themselves to. Paul resumes his appeal now as we leave this section here. He's going to resume his appeal for these Corinthians to recognize his apostolic authority. Are we on the same page now? Do you see where I'm coming from? I obviously made it sound like there wasn't a command to give, and there was a command to give. We read it in 1 Corinthians chapter 16. It was an order by Paul, just as he had given the Galatians, he gave the Corinthians. But he did not command them to abound. He did not command them to be generous. It is a free will offering. Paul's not going to command them to do something when it's a free will offering. But there is a command to lay by the store, so that there wouldn't be collections when he came through. So, starting in chapter 10, verse 1, "Now I, Paul, myself, urge you by the meekness and gentleness of Christ, I who am meek when face to face with you, but bold toward you in absence. I ask that when I am present, I need not be bold with the confidence with which I propose to be courageous against them who regard us as if we walked according to the flesh." I love this first verse. Chapter 10 and verse 1 is just awesome because we can just see Paul throwing it right back in the Judaizers' faces, right back in the false apostles' faces. What have they been saying about him? Exactly what he's pointing out here. I'm the guy who, when I'm around you, I am meek and gentle. But when I write you letters, they're just blasting letters. So I can be really bold to you in 10, but when I'm around you, I just can't do that. That's what he's been accused of. So Paul just takes that one step further. And now that Paul is talking about his apostolic authority, he emphasizes that he himself is urging the Corinthians, leaving out the references that he's been giving us the last few chapters to himself and Timothy and Titus. Timothy is the evangelist. Paul is the apostle. And now he's going to talk about his apostolic authority. This language is similar to what we ran into in Galatians chapter 5 and verse 2, which reads, "Behold, I, Paul, say to you that if you receive circumcision, Christ will be of no benefit to you. And I testify again to every man who receives circumcision that he is under obligation to keep the whole law. You have been severed from Christ, you who are seeking to be justified by law. you have fallen from grace. Paul, in this first part of chapter 10 here, is doing a very similar thing to what he did in chapter 5 of Galatians. He is saying, by my authority that I have been given, this is what must happen. And here he says, I myself, the apostle of Jesus Christ, Paul, urge you by the meekness and gentleness of Christ, I who am meek when face to face with you, but bold towards you in absence. You can just see that rolling off of his tongue, because that's what he's been accused of. And it isn't so. I ask that when I am present, I need not be bold with the confidence with which I propose to be courageous against some who regard us as if we walk according to the flesh. This is a direct refutation of what the false apostles have been saying about him. That he's a scatterbrain. That he's not going to stick to what he says. That he's just this meek and lowly guy. Not at all. So what is Paul getting ready to say in both verses? In both Galatians and here in the first verse of chapter 10, Paul is refuting what these false and malicious, the defamation of his character and of his apostleship by these false teachers. And we see this tone of voice throughout the entire letter, with the exception of chapter 8 and 9, where he's talking about the collection, and he gets into their generosity. The whole first 7 chapters, and then these last 3 chapters, are him defending his apostleship, telling the Corinthians that the things that they've been hearing about him, and the things that they know are true about him, are the things they need to stick to. The things that they've been being told that he's false apostles have no basis, because Paul was with them. Paul established the church there. They know who he is. They have no reason to believe these false apostles. So is the last part of verse 1 something Paul does, or is he referencing what the false apostles say about him? Is Paul really this guy who writes boldly but is meek among his people?
I think in a way it is true. I mean, we look at Paul, he's very generous when he's around people. He talks to them with respect. It's the love of Christ and the love of God that he's showing. Yes, some of his letters are very bold and very to the point. But it's also there, he can be bold in both places and he can be gentle in both places.
Do we have any doubt that if the Corinthian church hadn't changed, that he would have used his apostolic authority to bring change?
Sure.
Sure.
I think significant to notice here in the latter part of verse 1, he is, going to the first part of the verse, he is appealing to them on the basis of the meekness and gentleness of Christ. I think we're all aware of the fact that Jesus was that in terms of his submission to God's will, that he was by no means afraid to confront his enemies and to meet them openly. So many examples of that in his dealings with the Pharisees and the Sadducees as well. But what Paul goes on to say regarding the accusation against him, who in presence am lowly. In other words, he was basically nothing among them in person, face to face. But when you get away from them, then he would write these bold letters, as you read in the first chapter, exposing, reproving their errors and commanding them to correct them. So was he then a man who was unwilling to confront these people? basically afraid, a nothing when it came to exercising the authority of an apostle. He will correct that misimpression pretty strongly as we get into this.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that he wanted to make sure they understood. He was not afraid of anything that they had to say or do. Paul had been through so many things, and he bore, as he had told us, the stripes of Jesus. He had suffered through many ordeals because of his belief and his faith. And this kind of walks hand in hand with 1 Corinthians chapter 2 and verses 1 through 5, which reads, "When I came to you, brethren, I did not come with superiority of speech or of wisdom, proclaiming to you the testimony of God. For I determined to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and Him crucified. I was with you in weakness and in fear and in much trembling, and my message and my preaching were not in persuasive words of wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and of power, so that your faith would not rest on the wisdom of men, but on the power of God." We've talked about this before. Paul has said this before. Paul is not a steel-skinned giant. Paul is a man who suffered just like everybody else. But he endured. And who gets the credit for his endurance? Absolutely. And that's his point. "I come to you, and when I am with you, I am gentle. I bring to you the words of Christ, just as Christ was gentle." Does that mean Christ never showed any emotion? Does that mean Christ never did anything out of anger? No. And Paul, just as well, was capable of doing so. What he's saying here, this idea that has been developed for him by these false teachers, is that he's a patient man. And we talked about that earlier as well. Paul developed that idea that he did not want to come to Corinth when they were in the throes of their sin in order to have to exercise his apostolic authority. He was patient. He guided them in what they needed to do, gave them the knowledge they needed, and let them choose to do the right thing. And that's how the entire first part of this book is gone. That's how he was leading them in their contribution for the collection of the saints. He's not telling them what they have to do. He is guiding them, showing them what is the right thing to do. So, is this the way Paul describes himself, or is this the way they describe him? Well, Paul is repeating what the false teachers are just saying about him. That doesn't mean that he believes it, and that doesn't mean that it's so, either. But just as Jesus did not deem it necessary to shut down every single refutation of his authority, even though he demonstrated God's power time and time again, Paul did not need to do that either. Paul was an apostle of Christ with the powers that God had given him, the ability to work miracles. He did not need to demonstrate that any further, and wouldn't have done him any good anyway. How many miracles did Jesus perform in front of how many people? And what did they do to him? They killed him. So when Paul came to the Corinthians the first time, it was in much fear and trembling. Well, not fear of his life, not trembling in fear. It was in fear of God. He was establishing a congregation in a very wicked area. Did he fear for them? Was he anxious for them? Well, he tells us he was. But It was in a lowly, humble fear, the fear of God, the same fear we should have of our Lord. In verse 2 it reads, I ask that when I am present, I need not be bold with the confidence with which I propose to be courageous against some, who regard us as if we walk according to the flesh. So, verse 2 is an admonition to the Corinthians to do what? To defend Paul. And that's what he's been telling them since the beginning of this letter. To denounce the false teachers, whether they be Judaizers or idolaters or whoever else is coming through there. But verse 2, he's asking them that when he is present, he need not be bold with the confidence. Because if they were shutting down those false teachers like he told them to, he wouldn't have to be bold with confidence. He would not have to do that. Because the Corinthians would have already taken care of that problem. And that's what he's told them time and time again. If you're defending me because you know that I'm right, because the things that I've taught you are correct, then there's no reason for me to have to be bold among you, because you've taken care of it yourselves. He doesn't need to be bold with the confidence with which some propose to be courageous, with which I propose to be courageous against some, who regard us as if we walk according to the flesh. And that gets right to the heart of the matter. He's accusing those people of being fleshly. They are accusing him of being fleshly, but the whole argument turns on its head because they are accusing Paul of being the exact same thing that they are. When Paul comes through, he's not searching for food. He's not searching for money. He's not searching to be paid for his time. That's what these false teachers do. That's not what Paul does. Paul comes in meek and lowly, in fear and trembling, ready to do the work that needs to be done. In verse 3, and reading through verse 6, for though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not the flesh, but divinely powerful for the destruction of fortresses. We are destroying speculations and every lofty thing raised up against the knowledge of God. And we are taking every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. And we are ready to punish all disobedience whenever your obedience is complete. So who accused Paul of walking according to the flesh? And I gave you a couple of verses if you picked up the answer, the question sheet. Who accused Paul of walking according to the flesh? Looking over at chapter 11, it's just a jump ahead, one chapter. And verse 4, for if one comes and preaches another Jesus, whom we have not preached, or who you receive, or you receive a different spirit, which you have not received, or a different gospel, which you have not accepted, you bear this beautifully. There's three examples of what the Corinthians are dealing with there. They're dealing with a Jesus that is different from what Paul preached, a spirit which is different from the one that they already received, or a gospel which they haven't accepted. Those are three very pointed ideas. Does it sound like an idolater, a false teacher idolater, is going to be preaching a different Jesus? Or that he's going to be preaching a different spirit? Or that he's going to be preaching a different gospel? Those things could apply to an idolater, but it makes me think more and more by using those terms that he's dealing with these Judaizing teachers. And then flipping over to chapter 6 and verse 14 of 2 Corinthians. Do not be bound together with unbelievers, for what partnership have unrighteousness and lawlessness, or righteousness and lawlessness? Or what fellowship has light with darkness? This is something he already warned them about, that these false teachers that are coming in and preaching this different gospel, preaching this different Jesus, preaching this different spirit, are not the kind of people they want to be bound to. They don't want to listen to them. They want to deny those people. They want to send them down the road. These are not the people they want to be tied up with. And so, more and more as the language gets closer and closer to trying to copy what Paul has been preaching, it sounds to me more and more like he's dealing with some Judaizing teaching going on here, rather than the direct false teachers that are trying to pull them back into idolatry, which I don't doubt were there. Corinth was, again, as we had said, a major hub in the Roman Empire. So of course they were dealing with idolatry. Of course they were. But on top of that, they've been taught this message, and then they have these Judaizing preachers that are coming in and trying to bind them to law, to a law that no longer exists. And it sounds interesting, I guess. It sounded interesting to the Galatians, didn't it? They were falling head over feet into this idea that they needed to be circumcised, that they needed to be part of this law. It was pulling them down. I'm not saying that that's what's happening solely here in Corinth, because we know that they're dealing with other influences as well. But I can't discount the idea that these Judaizers who have been following Paul all over Galatia are following him now over into Achaia and into Macedonia, and are trying their best to refute everything he says. And idolaters, I don't think, would be teaching about a different Jesus. I think they'd be teaching about their gods. They don't need to copy this Jesus. That sounds more like what the Judaizers would be doing. So, Paul does not war according to the flesh. So who does? Absolutely. So in Romans, I gave you Romans chapter 8 and verses 5 through 8, which reads, "For those who are according to the flesh set their minds on the things of the flesh, but those who are according to the Spirit, the things of the Spirit. For the mindset on the flesh is death, but the mindset on the Spirit is life and peace. Because the mindset of the flesh is hostile towards God, for it does not subject itself to the law of God, for it is not even able to do so. And those who are in the flesh cannot please God." So, those who are warring with the flesh are those who are dead. Those who have chosen death rather than life and peace. That defines Satan. He is the great accuser, dragging people to their deaths. Those who refuse God and His glory. They're taught about Jesus. They're taught about the gospel. And they just flat deny it. They refuse to accept it. Those are the people who war according to the flesh, because that's all they can do. They don't accept the Spirit. They don't know what it is. They can't use it. They don't care about it. So they discard it. And those who accept God accept life and peace. And that's what Paul's telling them. He is not somebody who wars according to the flesh. And he's demonstrated that time and time again with them. He's been very patient with them as they've dealt with all of the different issues that they've been dealing with. So, Paul's military metaphor, and it is very military, isn't it? If you look at this, verses 3 through 6, "For though we walk according to the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not the flesh, but divinely powerful for the destruction of fortresses. We are destroying speculations and every lofty thing raised up against the knowledge of God, and we are taking every thought captive to the obedience of Christ, and we are ready to punish all disobedience whenever your obedience is complete. That's a very vivid word picture, isn't it? And in these times, in this place, they've seen the power of the Roman army. They've seen exactly what it does. It comes in, it conquers, it takes people captive, and hauls them away. They've seen that happen. And so when Paul paints this word picture like that, it's easy for them to understand what a powerful message he's trying to get across to them. His military metaphor in verses 4 and 5 end in the destruction and capture of the enemy. In this instance, who is capturing the enemy and who is responsible for the enemy's destruction? Is it Paul that's doing this? Or does he give the credit where credit is due? As he says, we are destroying speculations and every lofty thing raised up against the knowledge of God. And we are taking every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. So he gives God the credit for what is happening here. Paul is using God's weapons to capture the hearts and the minds of these people, as he has been the entire time. Those who war with the flesh, like those false teachers that we're talking about, don't give God the credit. All they can do is accuse and blame. They do the same thing Satan does. He accuses and blames. And God is the one working through Paul. Paul's weaknesses only magnify the fact that God is working through him, and that God is in control, and that God will execute his judgment as he sees it fit. So the false apostles are encouraging the Corinthians to be shallow and look at outward appearances. And that's because they do not have Paul's authority. But the false apostles claim what in verse 7? Well, let's read it. You are looking at things as they are outwardly. If anyone is confident in himself that he is Christ, let him consider this again within himself, that just as he is Christ, so also are we. So what he's saying there is that if you are of Christ, then you're going to recognize those who are in Christ. And Paul showed them who Christ was, demonstrated the gospel to them, showed them the power of Christ. And when they see these false apostles, it should be very easy for them to tell the difference between one who is in Christ and one who is not. What he's saying here is that those who have been teaching them are not of Jesus. Paul is of Jesus. The apostles that they have seen come through there are of Jesus. They have demonstrated Jesus' power. They have demonstrated Jesus' message. But these false teachers are not. Boy, I don't know where I got that. That's not what I meant to put up there. Paul is of Christ. The question is, that's because they do not have false authority, but the false apostles claim what in verse 7? Well, they're claiming that Paul is not of Jesus, that he's not an apostle. And that's what we've seen before. We've seen that the Judaizers or these false teachers, they claim that Paul is not what he is. They claim that Paul is not an apostle because he did not walk with Christ like the rest of the apostles did. He was not with him when he died on the cross. He was not part of those men, one of those men who demonstrated that they were with him the entire time. In fact, Paul was on the opposite end of the spectrum when Jesus was walking on this earth. And so they accuse him of not being an apostle. They accuse him of not being a Christ. Until Paul demonstrates that he is a Christ. He shows the Corinthians, the Galatians, the Thessalonians, all those in Macedonia and Achaia, his message of his gospel, of the gospel of Christ. He shows them the power that has been granted him to demonstrate that gospel. Paul begins his boast of apostolic authority in verse 8, and he boldly claims that his proof of authority will not what? Let's read through this. Verses 8 through 11. For even if I boast somewhat further about our authority, which the Lord gave for building you up, and not for destroying you, I will not be put to shame. For I do not wish to seem as if I would terrify you by my letters. For they say his letters are weighty and strong, but his personal presence is unimpressive, and his speech contemptible. Let such a person consider this, that what we are in word by letters, when absent, such persons we are also indeed when present. So he boldly claims that his proof of authority will not what? His proof of authority will not cause shame. He can demonstrate his proof of authority. Can the false teachers do the same? Can they demonstrate that they are of Christ? Can they demonstrate the power of God? Have they ever been able to? Absolutely not. And he had used the same idea earlier when he had told the Corinthians that he didn't want them to be shamed and he didn't want himself to be shamed by them not demonstrating or completing their work, which he advised them to do. It brings shame upon the one who says that if they can do something and they don't accomplish that. And if Paul says he's an apostle, but he cannot accomplish the things that an apostle needs to do, that is to demonstrate the gospel and to demonstrate God's authority, then it brings shame upon himself and it brings shame upon those who listen to him. And Paul says here, I will not be put to shame, for I do not wish to seem as if I would terrify you by my letters. The point of his letters was not to scare them, was not to terrify them. What was it? What were the point of his letters?
To encourage them to confirm who he really was. The apostleship was true.
Were some of the things in his letters scary? Why were they scary? The truth hurts, doesn't it? It's a terrible thing to be confronted with the fact that you're wrong and that you need to make yourself right. That's a scary thing. And when it's at the point of death, and we're not talking physical death, but spiritual death, well, that can be a scary thing. And it's amazing to us to find that the Corinthians ignored or overlooked or didn't recognize the sin that was in their midst. Whether that was the sinful man or these false teachers. But they were just nonchalantly allowing these things to happen in their midst. And the letter that Paul, both letters that Paul wrote to them, were wake-up calls. That this isn't okay. You cannot be doing this. There is a price to pay for your laziness, for your inability to get the job done. So Paul's authority is granted by God, and his authority will never prove false. Unlike these false apostles, Paul's boast of his authority will never prove hollow. If Paul says he can do something, he will accomplish that. the false teachers couldn't say the same thing. They would not be able to follow through on their word. Paul doesn't want to frighten all of these Corinthians with his letters, but he does want to frighten who? Judaizing teachers and those Corinthians who have chosen to side with those false teachers. Those idolatrous apostles. His point here is he's aiming his letters at the disobedient, at the ones who should be listening the most. Those who have changed their hearts and have refuted the false apostles, who were part of the majority that chose to disassociate themselves from this man who had been sinning, Paul doesn't really have to say that much to them because they've got the idea. But the part of the congregation who didn't care, the part of the congregation who chose to just overlook what was happening, that's who he's targeting. That's who these letters are written to, and that's who he's trying to frighten. He's not trying to frighten them with some scary vision or some scary idea, but he's trying to wake them up, to make them understand that they have to change. He's aiming it at the disobedient. And it is not the faithful majority that Paul is trying to frighten into action, but those who are listening to these false apostles, who are willing to take the message that Paul is what they are claiming he is, this person who is bipolar. He writes strongly, but then when he gets there, he's a meek little mouse. Paul is what he is. He's meek when he needs to be meek, and he's bold when he needs to be bold. And he told us that himself. He is all things to all men. So Paul reminds the Corinthians that he is the same man in letter and in physical presence. If Paul threatens to discipline in his letters, and the attitudes and actions do not change, what will happen when Paul comes? And this isn't a trick question. Paul will be forced to use his apostolic authority to discipline the disobedient. And it's as easy as that. He gave them the information they needed. He gave them a guide. He gave them the gospel. When they failed to follow the gospel, when they failed to follow the guide, he told them there would be consequences. And then those consequences will be enforced when he comes if it is necessary. And he told them that. That ends the first part of chapter 10. We're going to finish chapter 10 next week. I didn't think I'd have time to get into it. So we're going to finish verses 12 through 18, which is an appeal for the Corinthians to recognize Paul's God-assigned area of mission and to help them cover it. He's basically going to get into here and tell the Corinthians that, yes, it was Paul's job. It was his designation to go to the Gentiles and to take the gospel to as many Gentiles as he possibly could. And Paul did that. He was all over Asia. He was all over Macedonia and Achaia. He even wanted to go to Spain. We know he was in Rome. He was everywhere. Paul went all over the then known world to spread that message to as many Gentiles as he possibly could. But he's telling the Corinthians that they've been given the gospel. Now use it. Spread it. help me cover this area with the gospel. Yes, I will be taking it to as many faraway places as I possibly can. But you can do the same thing. And so we'll get into that next week. We'll be covering chapter 10, verses 12 through 18. Were there any other questions or comments?